Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Suvankam Tamavongsa, whose first story collection, How to Pronounce Knife, was published on April 21st by Little Brown. Suvankam's work has appeared in Harper's, The Paris Review, The Atlantic, Granta, Noon, one of my favorites. She's the author of four poetry books, Cluster, Light, Found, and Small Arguments. How to Pronounce Knife is in 14 stories. Stories ostensibly about Laotians, but stories that could be about anybody. There are stories about not fitting in, about loneliness, about dreams that are never realized, about unfairness, and surprisingly enough, about laughter. Laughter that kind of flies in the face of all these challenges and losses. Sometimes we're not sure of time or place, or even if we're still talking about Laotians or expatriates, but we're always certain of the feelings, of the emotions of those we get to know intimately. So these are stories you won't forget, and also stories that resonate sometimes with nostalgia, sometimes with embarrassment or shame, but always stories that are true. So with that, welcome, Suvankam, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here.
Well, so one of the things I thought about, and I don't know if it's really true, but how did you feel like you, what is the transition from poetry to short stories like? Because I still find your short stories poetic.
Thank you. I didn't want to scare myself. So I knew, I've been writing poetry for 25 years. And so I knew I just had to take it sentence by sentence. I know what writing is. I know how to dramatize a moment. And I knew I could take those things and bring it into a different, like, I just think of the short story form as a different container or a different sport, the way that we think of like basketball and baseball. They're different set of rules and you play by them. But at the center of each of those things is a spectacular athlete. And that's what I wanted to be.
It's funny because, as I said, when it reminds me of poetry, and I know you like William Carlos Williams, when the teacher at the beginning in How Do You Pronounce Knife, when you hear tap, 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 it's just three words repeated, but it reminds me of poetry, kind of like the red wheelbarrow, because I know why does something depend on a red wheelbarrow? You don't know. It's like in Pink Floyd's Comfortably Numb. You know, you see something out of the corner of your eye and then you turn to look at it and it's gone. And that's what poetry has always kind of meant to me. And and I find that throughout many of the stories, even the one title, which is, I am embarrassed to say it, but it's like, but how do you say it since you wrote it?
It's supposed to sound like rusty door hinges, so it would sound like like that. I think I know what you mean in terms of like sound. Sound is really important to these stories. The sound of the sentence, the sound of people's speech, the sound of the title, the sound that a story begins on or ends on, like an Edge of the World. That whole story, it ends on the sound of a laughter and on the image of a mouth that's open, or even the title itself, like How to Pronounce Knife. That title has some focuses on the word knife, which has something to do with sound and the way that we all agree to see a letter there, but we don't pronounce it.
It's like what you were saying, I think, at one time in one of the interviews about Lao, even though you weren't really there that long.
Yeah.
It's like you talked about how in Lao there's so many words that sound like what they are.
Yes, like it really, I think about it as you mean what you say. Like when you talk about a cat, it sounds like what it is. Like a cat, the Lao word for cat is meow, and it sounds like the sound that a cat makes.
Yeah, and the funny thing is it also reminds me, I wanted to go through each story, and we already kind of are doing it because we talked about the edge of the world and nice, but if you go to Randy Travis,
yeah.
And the thing about, I know you like country music, and the way you describe it, the reason you like it is because these songs are simple, they say what they mean,
yeah.
And
they care about story and the sentence itself. And they care about voice, like the way that a country singer phrases a particular vowel, that's important to the way that they sing it.
Yeah, it's funny. Hey, have you ever seen the video Country Forever?
No.
It's really good. They made it for the Country Music Awards, but then it won the Country Music Award the next year. And it's got like 20 different country music stars.
Oh.
You got to see it. It's called Country Forever. You have to watch it. You will absolutely love it. But the thing that's so poignant about it is it has like Dolly Parton and Willie Nelson and all the old guys and Keith Urban, all of them. Uh-huh. But it also has Randy Travis in it, but he can't sing anymore because he has.
Yeah.
So he's just sitting in a chair on the porch, and it's just a mm-hmm. shot of him just mm-hmm. sitting there. And it's a mashup of Country Rose, On the Road Again, and that Dolly Parton one, I Will Love You Forever, whatever that one is. And it mashes them all up. It's really good. You'll love it. So if we go back to the country music and we go back to Knife.
Yeah.
The story Knife reminds me of that song by Dolly Parton, Coat of Many Colors.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just like that. You know, it's like you think that your parents have told you something that's right. And
right.
then you say it and then the blonde girl rolls her eyes and you're embarrassed.
In Dolly Parton's song Coat of Many Colors, there's a child that thinks that it is the coat she's wearing is this coat of many colors, and it's really beautiful and magical, and it's made with such love by her mother. But then when she goes to school, it's thought to be ugly and a bunch of rags, and it changes her sense of where she comes from. And very much the short story How to Pronounce Knife, the child's parents tells her how to pronounce this word knife as knife. And she believes this, and she goes to school and she pronounces it that way, but then discovers that that's not how you say it at all, in the same way that the child in Coat of Many Colors realizes that what she has on is considered to be rags.
And in that story, as in many others, when the little girl comes home with a note pinned to her clothes, she protects her parents. And just like when they come to school and everyone's dressed up and she says, oh, isn't that funny, they dressed up, she protects them again. And then she protects them with regard to the word. And that reoccurs in many of the stories. And like, I think it's in The Edge of the World. Right.
Right.
When the mother goes to bed and she's laying with the daughter and the daughter's reading to her.
Right.
It's
making up stories.
Yeah. And it's funny how you do that, how the kids, because the parents are having such a hard time in so many ways,
the tables get turned.
Exactly.
I think that's very common, in that sometimes children have to parent their parent. And sometimes, you know, we often talk about, or like any parent, any immigrant refugee parent will always talk about the kind of sacrifices they make for their children, but their children also make sacrifices as well, like decisions like what to tell the parent about the world, like even in a far distant thing, there's someone at work calls the father thief, but the father doesn't understand what this word means, and then comes home and asks the child, what is this word? Everyone's calling me this at work. What does thief mean? And then the child says, oh, I've never heard of that word before. I have no idea.
And it's funny the way you put it again, poetically, how they say it almost as if they're spitting at him, but they don't spit. And then all he's doing is the right thing. He's working hard, and they don't want him to work hard
because it makes everyone else look bad.
Right. It's like being in the union and you're being told, you know, just lean on the shovel every once in a while. And that happened to me when I worked. I was working in a TV picture tube plant back. I mean, I'm old. So back when there were really picture tubes, cathode ray tubes, and I was working too fast. And the union people told me, Sam, you need to slow down. I didn't understand it. I still don't understand it. But, you know, oh, that reminds me of okay, Paris. You know, I'm really proud of Red, and you do these nickname things, but I'm really proud of Red that she even was able to get a truck. I was thinking, you know, this is pretty good that she was able to do this. That's how the story started out for me. I was going, that's really good that she did that for herself. So what's the deal about noses? Do Laotians really do that?
Well, I remember when I was a kid, it was a fad. I remember coming home from a party, sitting in the back seat, and my parents gossiping about the people at the party. Like my mom was saying, oh, did you notice her? Her nose changed. But I knew that in this talk that my mom was having with my dad, she really wanted him to reassure her that she was beautiful to him. And I knew that. And I listened in on this private conversation. And I just remembered the things that my dad said about the people at the party that I thought was funny. That also, you know, reassured my mom that the nose she has is really beautiful, and that it belonged to her, and that it was real. So that's what made it beautiful.
And there's another thing that's like that in, wait a minute, which is the story? I thought I had them all down. You know, where he says, yes, sir, but it really means.
Oh.
Well, since it's podcast, I can say it. When he says, yes, sir, he really means fuck you.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting thing about that. Like, my father's country club where he plays golf, there's a black guy that shines shoes, and he's always like so pleasant, but you know that inside he's basically saying, you know, he's doing the same thing. And it's a really interesting defense mechanism, and it's also kind of taking power in a way. You know, you're taking power.
Right. And it's also, it's like, oftentimes, whenever we encounter stories of immigrants and refugees, often we're not allowed to be messy or bad. We're expected to be noble, kind, and nice. But then that makes us so one-dimensional as people. And I wanted a moment to say, yeah, he's saying, yes, sir, but this is what he means privately. As a reader, I took a bit of joy in that moment in the story.
So did I. And it makes me, I always like it because it's not like you have a second sense, but I have a kind of insight, and you can tell when someone's doing it. And I think it's funny. And they thought it was really funny, too, because when he goes home, he tells it to everyone, and it's like a joke to everybody.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
think it's cool that he's doing it, which I did, too. And it's funny, too. You have these people that you think at first are losers, but – and I guess Manny Petty is a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good poetic title. And also Cheap Cheap is a good poetic.
Actually, that idea – came from, well, my brother, he's a welder, but before he was a welder, he wanted to start up his own business making signs, and he wanted to call it Chickadee Signs. And it's something, my dad makes signs, and it's something that he says to every client that comes into his shop. Like, they say, I want to make signs. And then he says, cheap, cheap. You know, just, you know, he's very efficient with language. And so he, that's what he says to them. And so that was going to be, that was my brother's idea to have a sign making company. And its slogan would be cheap, cheap.
It's pretty good that it actually came like that. The thing about it is that, you know, he's a loser. Raymond is a loser as a boxer, and then he's right. kind of a loser when he starts out working, and then all of a sudden he becomes a winner. And I love his sister because she's so mean, but she's so funny too.
You know, it's tough love, right? She feels like life will be hard on him, and if she could give him the harshness, he would be better prepared for life. Sometimes the people who are most harsh with us are also the people who are the closest to us. And I wanted to capture that moment. I think at any new job, we always feel like a loser because we don't know how to do it until we do. And for Raymond, I wanted to show that, you know, one dream can fail, but it doesn't mean you fail as a person. You can start somewhere else and you can thrive in a place where people don't think you can thrive, like a boxer in a nail salon.
Yeah, but two things. First of all, tough love, yes. But she really does get pissed off when he gets $20 and $30 tips. She's not happy about that at all.
That's true.
And also, the other thing, and this is kind of like a gnomon of the entire book, which is kind of sad, but, well, no, actually, even though we always, in your interviews, you always, and people always talk about the humor in the book, and yes, it's there. Right. And, but she does have the thing that is about the book. She says, you got to remember, Raymond, you got to not have dreams.
Right.
So that's kind of different than what you just said. So the reader takes away something different. You're saying that Raymond's dream is not realized, but then again, he can always dream something else.
Right.
But she's telling him, don't, you're really hanging yourself out there.
Right. But also, we know that what she's telling him isn't truly what she thinks. It's just something that has been said to her that maybe she feels she needs to repeat for her brother. I think sometimes that's how like racism works, in that you're often told not to have your dreams, and then you actually believe it, and then you tell the people you love the same thing.
What do you think about, okay, so like this is your first book of short stories.
Right. And
so what do you think about, okay, you let this book of short stories, your first child, so to speak, go out into the world. And what do you think about me as the reader saying to you that she means you can't have dreams at all? So am I allowed to interpret it that way? Does that bother you?
No, because I think it's there. Everybody brings their own life experience, their own interpretation, and I can't control what people think or how they will interpret what the book is or what a moment is. And I feel like even if it's a little off, or it doesn't have to be exact, the most important thing to me is that it's read and that it's felt by someone.
Yeah, I agree with that too.
Yeah.
What about, so I wouldn't want to work with feet either, but I certainly wouldn't want to get warts. I don't know if the two are necessarily connected, but I would not want to work with feet, and I don't blame them. So like in Chikichie, once again, there's a mistake, a lingual mistake. But in this case, it turns out to be helpful. So they get, like, I would have been so happy when I was a kid. They get this enormous bag of candy. But the thing about it, you're talking about racism, is like when Harold comes out, the husband, and he says, oh, it's so adorable.
Right.
What is it that's adorable? Is it adorable but that these little kids are, did they think this is the way it sounds? Is it adorable because they look the way they look? Again, what is it? Is it the reverse of what it should be?
Well, it's a question that arises and that lingers and haunts the story, and I want it to do that. It makes you question, what is it that Harold and his wife is giving to these children? Is it pity? Or like, what is it? Do they feel sorry for these children? But at the same time, it doesn't really matter because the candy is in the bag, right?
Yeah.
Does it really? I mean, like, yeah.
Right. They only see Harold for a second, and the key is that they get a bag of potato chips too, which is not a usual trick or treat candy, but I would take it.
Yeah.
You know, and then going back to the story Slingshot, This is really funny for me, because first when she says she's 70 and he's a kid basically, and then I realized, shit, I'm 68. And then I thought, well, it's like she says, you're in your body, but That's just the body. So it's like when I look in the mirror, all I see is me. That's the only person I've ever seen in the mirror is me. And it's not like I change. It's still just me. But it's interesting because the other thematic thing in this work, and especially with her relationship here, is that there's constantly this idea that, well, especially in the gas station, there's this idea that, and he even says it, that love is a construct, which is an odd thing for him to say, I think, because it's a very intellectual thing to say. Mm-hmm. And throughout the book, there is this idea, the way she just, and people in the book just pack their bags and go away. Mm-hmm. And when the mother says, when you have a story about boobs, and the grandmother says, it's love isn't there. And then when she says what she says at the end, it's like, you're telling everybody, I don't mean it that way. But what you take away is the fact that there's this idea that love, not for just people from a country, but for everybody, might not really be there. But that sounds pessimistic for someone so young as you.
Maybe. I think there are variations of love. I think in particular for Slingshot, I wanted to say, there's always, I get really angry when I watch like a rom-com or read about stories where there's where you get your person. And I wanted to write a story where it could still feel incredibly profound to not get the person. In Slingshot, I wanted to show that love isn't everything and it's not enough. You have to recognize, you have to be able to see it and have the courage to move toward it and hold it. It's not enough that it's there. And that's what I wanted people to get out of Slingshot. And in the gas station, it's so powerful and freeing not to be afraid to be alone, to walk away and not to dwell on this idea that, that you love. it's okay to let it go. The act of love is, you know, something you do. You don't need to depend on someone else for it.
Well, okay. I would kind of say that's kind of cynical for someone as young as you, but it's kind of cool in a way too. You know who I felt the most sorry for in the book? And this is so, and this is again, because you're a poet, Daniel. I mean, Daniel's not even in the book. He's in for like,
He's in for like two sentences. He is the one who, he says the right thing, you know, and he's the one who, he's the only one in the story, Slingshot, who can see the love too. But he's the one who doesn't get to live out the end of it. I think minor characters in a story can have a profound effect to the whole of a story. You don't have to be the main character, the center of the story, to have like a starring role. You can have like a very tiny but shining and brilliant moment. And I loved writing that character, Daniel.
And the thing about it is, he didn't even have to be a character, because again, poetically, the most important thing he does in just two words is a wink.
Right.
And that's that comes from you being a poet, I assume. I mean, it seems like it does, because it's just, you know, it's like a cliche, but a poem should not mean but be. It's just a wink. And then, you know, you go, well, why does that even mean anything? But then it means everything.
It
you know?
Does, yeah.
I don't know. It's weird. And then the other story that was really cool was The Universe Would Be So Cruel. They're great titles. And, you know, Mr. Vong is like this really cool guy. And I'm, you know, it's not like it's magical realism, but, you know, how does he do what he does? How does he know that? And then he does beautiful work. And then once again, he kind of, at the end, he kind of sacrifices, yeah. You know, he sacrifices, but in a much different way than anybody else does in the book.
Yeah. He is very proud of the work he does, but he's the one who puts himself on the line to explain a very cruel thing that happens to his daughter, because it's easier to be the person who takes the blame than to have to explain that maybe someone left you because they don't love you. That's very hard to say to somebody you love and care about. There's no need to even say that. So you take it on yourself and you say, oh, it's because I forgot the invitation. It fell behind the door.
Yeah. He is a master at what he does, and yet he says something that, I don't know, especially when you're sacrificing for your children, it's much better to have someone think badly of you if you, by doing that, make your children happier, or like they didn't make the mistake. And, right. You know, it's being a good parent, and he has to give up his reputation in order to make, oh, and the guy, you know, you don't even talk about the guy, but, you know, he's a complete asshole. The guy who leaves her, who jilts her, but you don't even talk about him. You don't know who he is.
I write the scene with a single word. I use the word jilted, and that's all. It is its own sentence. I don't describe who he is or what he or, you know, in much detail what he does, because I trust the reader to put the story together. And, you know, there's no need to watch somebody like suffer so horribly. You can just use one word to finish the scene.
Yeah. And not to beat a dead horse, but once again, that's the essence of poetry. It's just one word. And again, William Carlos Williams, so comes around. And we talked a little bit about the edge of the world, and this idea of a wild laugh, which is really scary. And then especially at the end when she's looking in the mirror and she's looking down her throat, which also was really scary too.
Right.
And yeah, it's just, first, like in the beginning, you wonder, why is this laugh coming? And then at the end, you kind of wonder, why is this laugh coming? Yeah. But you kind of understand it too. But I couldn't explain it to you. I couldn't explain that story to you. Can you explain it to me?
I think, you know, sometimes we laugh at inappropriate moments. Sometimes the act of laughter in our bodies, when we force ourselves to laugh, sometimes it just cheers and lifts our mood, even when we don't mean it to. You know, laughter isn't always for joy or for something funny. Sometimes we do it inappropriately at moments where we don't expect laughter to happen. I've seen this at a funeral before where, you know, like people, like someone laughed and they didn't, you know, they didn't mean to, but it was just so horribly sad and unbearable for them that it just came out that way.
I did it once at a I went with my mother to the funeral of her best friend. And for some reason, well, I always did this to my mom. In the middle of the funeral, I kind of laughed. And then she started laughing. And this was her best friend. And so everyone turns around. My mother's laughing hysterically. And it was like, she says, I'm never taking you to a funeral again.
Well, you know, sometimes we also have like fits of giggles at inappropriate moments. And I just thought that was a sound and an act that I wanted to explore in a story.
Yeah, now I understand. Well, yes, now I get it. But the other one that has, it's problematic, I guess, is the school bus driver, because as a reader, you're looking at Jay, mm-hmm. and how does he put up with what he's putting up with? How can he do that? And when Saturday comes and they go into the bedroom and all that, how does he put up with this? And at first you're thinking, you know, don't be that. Stand up, for you know, man up, you know, right. Whatever you would say. And then at the end, what you do is really strange, but really good. It's like he's in the parking lot, shoveling the snow. The snow is really light. It's easy to shovel. He gets the ticket. He folds the ticket. He puts it in his wallet. He sees the picture of his wife. And then he sees his driver's license. And then his name is Chai.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell?
I think that story is very unusual because Jai is very isolated. His wife's boss. They create a world for him that is unpleasant. But to take it further, even the narrator telling the story is unkind to him and often just calls him the school bus driver as well. So as a character, he's completely alone. And as a reader, you just want to, you know, go into the story and grab him and say,
you're right.
Exactly. Hey, buddy. I'm here for you. What you're being told that, oh, this is the way friendships are formed in this country. You know, like you just want to say, no, that's not true. In the end, all he has is his name and the meaning of his name, and he holds on to it. And as a reader, you want him to.
Yeah. And I don't know why it reminds me of this, but when you're talking about Red, and at the end, and this happens sometimes, it's happened with me, with friends and people I know, it's when Nicole and she hug at the end.
Right.
And she says it couldn't have, she goes, it could have been anybody. But then again, you go, well, maybe it And then she goes, well, maybe it couldn't have been anybody.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah, probably. And then they hug, and they're hugging for different reasons. And it's like when you tell somebody your problems, yeah, and they tell you, and they want to tell you their problems.
Yeah.
And your problems are completely different.
Yeah.
But then again, they're equal in ways. And
because you're in that moment together, and there's a compassionate listener or a compassionate touch. And it doesn't matter if the stories are different. You're in that moment together, and there's somebody listening.
Yeah. And they're both crying for different reasons.
Yeah.
And then before that, you like, it's interesting, you know, because Nicole, she's got a nice car. She's got her fur coat. She's got the right nose. She's got her blonde hair. But then her fur coat gets covered with mud, and Red says it could have been shit, you know.
Yeah.
And then they hug after that. And it's like, I don't know. You create an equivalence, but at the same time, a diametrical position. So they're the same, and yet they're completely different,
mm-hmm,
at exactly the same moment.
Well, for Nicole, she has everything that as a woman you're taught or you're told you should have: the house, the husband, the car, the family, the looks, the money. But Red is alone, and she's everything that, you know, we're taught that if you are like Red, you're a loser. But are you? Because Red is, even though she's alone, she has some form of happiness that is a degree above Nicole. And so are they, is Nicole's life better? Is it?
Because Red can go home and be happy.
Right.
And you say that.
Yeah.
And it's like this living in the moment kind of thing, which I can do maybe three times a day. But if you do live in the moment, yes, you can be happy. You know, it's a beautiful sunny day or whatever it is. And if you just take out all the buzz or take out who's more powerful or what is being said to you that's wrong, you can still be happy.
In the story Paris, it takes place in a chicken processing plant. The characters, the town, that is not Paris. But the title, because it is the title, I know that readers, I lean on the idea that readers know, you know, Paris, France, that it's idea of culture and sophistication and class. And you take that into the story, and you don't ever, nobody ever gets to Paris. Even the people who work in the front office, the people who have money, they don't get to Paris. And neither do the people who don't have money to get to Paris. Nobody gets to Paris.
No, everybody gets fried chicken every year. Which is hilarious. That's really funny too. I mean, yeah. So let's see. Oh yeah. So the gas station. So Mary, just like we were talking about, she considers herself there's two kinds of people in the world, and she's one, the one that's unseen, the unseen person. But yet, and another really funny thing is when he comes to get his taxes done or whatever, and she goes, no, you need an appointment, and there's nobody there, but I'm a professional. And then he makes the appointment. But then there's this, what you do is, you know, the guy is grotesque. You make him grotesque, especially when you do the hair on his chest kind of thing. And, but yet, as in other situations in the story about physical attraction, she's got this incredible attraction to him, and she has to consummate it. And once again, it's really hard to understand, but then again, it's easy to understand. And I don't know how you do that. How did you go about constructing that one?
That one. Yeah, that was a moment. I remember talking to my editor about she didn't understand why a woman would just show up at a man's place without an invitation. And, you know, in stories, when women are not allowed to be creepy, if they show intense emotion, it's like fatal attraction. I mean, I was thinking of, you know, the actress Glenn Close in that movie. She's the one who had, I just felt she was such an amazing character. She was the one with feeling, the one with passion, the one who was in charge and where love was located. And but why is she the bad person? And I just wanted to write a story where that was a main character, or that intensity, that intensity of desire is the main feeling and the main character. And, you know, nobody is going to die in the end in that, in my story.
But me being, again, a white male, older, I didn't like her in that role because of the same reason why your editor didn't. If she or he didn't, it's because she scared me. You know, that scares me. I don't want to see a woman doing that. And well, and that's, and the premise of the movie was exactly that too.
Yeah.
You know, it played off of stereotypes. This is, she played against type, which sometimes is the best kind of story there is. Oh yeah.
I think it's okay to be scared of another person's intensity. It doesn't mean that we can't see them in stories just because they're a bit scary to us.
Two things I meant to mention to you. One is you like pencil skirts.
Oh, I do. Well, I do wear a lot of them. They are just very neat and convenient, and they go for with every occasion, I feel.
Yeah, I like them too, but you have to be skinny. Not skinny, I didn't mean it that way. You have to be slender. And the other thing is, since I'm American, you know, you mentioned Canadian Tire twice. And no one here knows what Canadian Tire is, other than the fact that her boots are Canadian Tire, so it's kind of like, you know.
Right.
That's all she can afford to wear.
Well, that's like Canadian Tire is like Home Depot.
Yeah. And I researched it because I didn't know what it was. And now I know exactly what it is, which is great. Oh. I know everything about it, that they took over 12 Target stores in Canada, that they tried to come into America as like a Western Auto bought their stores. It's like, there's something wrong with me. Why do I do this?
Well, Canadian Tire, they do a lot there. You know, you could get your car fixed. You could buy food. You could buy household items. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very interesting company, and they make a lot of money. I had no idea. And they've been around since like the 20s.
Yep.
All right. I don't want to go off on Canadian Tire.
Okay. So, you seem like a fan of it.
Well, it's like, you know, once you start Googling something and right. Then, you know, you just, and then you read the Wikipedia entry, which I love Wikipedia, but none of the teachers at my kids' schools let them use it. And it's so much better than textbooks, but everyone continues to deny it as being unreliable. And the paradoxical thing about that is if you go to Wikipedia and say, is Wikipedia reliable? It says Wikipedia is unreliable. So it's like this paradox, like this sentence is true. No, this sentence is false.
Well, I think when you read things on Wikipedia, you have to know a little bit about the thing you're looking up. It's sort of like Google. I mean, you have to have some knowledge if you want to read, if you want to look something up, you have to narrow it down in order to filter out what you want to find.
Yeah. Well, if you have, Yeah, if you're if you know how to ask the right question.
Yeah.
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 So I think we covered them. Oh no, we didn't cover them all. We covered everything except picking worms. And when I was a kid, you know, it really is hard to pick a worm without breaking it.
Totally.
And they do elongate tremendously. But this story was really unfair. And I don't know if it's really this bad in America for, you know, I was going to say like you guys, which is also racist. But for your characters, because, you know, he's only 14 years old. You think they really would give him that job? And she was so much better than him. And then all of a sudden he turns evil. And it's like overnight.
Is it though? Or what? Is it the job?
Well, he changes the rules to make her.
But where did that pressure? I mean, I don't describe it in the story about, you know.
Yeah, you do.
Wearing the equipment. Like, did a 14-year-old boy, you know, come up with that equipment change? Or was that upper management? We just know that it changes her and the way she does things.
Well, there's a dichotomy there because, like with the prom, he's at the door.
Yeah.
And he's different. He really wants to go, and he's out there, you know, gesticulating wildly and doing all the stuff he does. And she's holding her finger up to the peephole, which reminded me of Randy Travis when they're seeing him on stage and she takes her finger like that. And it's like the same thing. It's like, and then she closes her fingers and pushes him out. Like the way she writes the letters to him and says, I do not like you. It's like the cat in that. It's like, I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like you. But yeah, so, and actually kind of to conclude this, it's interesting that that boy, she resents him completely. And then the daughter, who's not that good at picking worms, at the end, she shuts him out. And once again, is she doing it out of respect for her mother? Is she doing it because she doesn't like him because of what he did? Is she doing it because of some other reason? And it's nice that you leave it to the reader to decide.
Right. It's all of those questions that I want to raise. But sometimes, you know, I've seen reviewers and some readers read that story, and all they want to say is, all they talk about is privilege in the workplace. But for me, it goes a bit further because, so this 14-year-old boy has privilege in the workplace, but at the end of the day, he's still a 14-year-old boy. And what is more powerful than a 14-year-old boy is a 14-year-old girl who can break his heart. And that is, you know, the story for me.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Well, on that note, I think we covered every story, and I loved everyone, and it's a great and I have this independent bookstore, and the thing about it is that your book is there on the front table, but because of our times, no one can come in and get it. But
you know what? It kind of reminds me of this store, this art project. I was in Marfa, Texas, and I saw this little display. It is a Prada store in the middle, on the way to Marfa, Texas. There's this Prada store, but no one can go inside. And that is the point of the artist's project, that here's this Prada store, but you remain on the outside. So it's kind of funny that that you say that here is this book and you can see it through the glass, but you can't go inside to get it.
Well, at least for your benefit and for mine, you know, we still have the curbside thing. The book is in the window so people see it, and it's got a great cover. And also Ingram, our distributor, we'll now drop ship anywhere. So, you know, and then we publicize it on all of our media. Like I said, we'll do with this story as well. But in any event, it was a pleasure talking to you. And
I'm so happy that you picked up this book and read it so deeply and had some really great questions. And I could tell there was some real joy in the way that you talked about the stories. I really enjoyed you laughing at some really, you know, it's like a comedian where you put in these moments where you want the audience to laugh and then it happens. And it's such a wonderful feeling. It makes you feel like you really did something.
That's great. I'm glad that I made you feel that way then. So thank you so much. And
thank you.
And hopefully we'll talk again.
Okay.
Okay. I'll see you.
Okay. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So we were talking with Suvankam Thamavongsa, and I'm very proud that I can pronounce her name properly. She congratulated me as well. Her book is, and it's her first book, she's a poet, and the book reads like poetry in so many different ways. It's How to Pronounce Knife, and it's a book of short stories. And I love short stories. Sometimes I would say definitely I like them better than novels, simply because, yes, they're compact, but you tell a really good story, and when you're done, of course they do, and when you're done, you have it, it's wrapped up, you know what it was about. And even if it leaves you questioning, you can just move on to the next one. But she does it in such a poetic fashion that it's a pleasure to read them. And she thanked me for reading it so closely, but you couldn't help it. It was just so good. So in any event, I wish her a lot of luck, but I don't think she's going to need it. I think that she's going to move on with her stories and probably move on to some novels as well. But you can always go back and look at her poetry. She's won lots of awards for it. Anyway, so thanks for joining us. And as I've always said, there's so many different ways you can get in contact with us, and you can access our interviews through pretty much every aspect of social media that there is, including our website, including Podomatic, including iTunes, including Twitter, including Instagram, including Facebook, which I usually forget to say. And it's very easy to do so. And from now on, I'll announce these things in order, because that's the order that I'm going to post them up on Podomatic. So anyway, yeah, I had a great time talking to Suvankam. And the next podcast that I'll post after this is going to be Pam Zhang, who's writing about, oh yeah, Suvankam's book is about Laos and people from Laos and how they're treated in this country and things like that. This book by Pam Zhang is called How Much of These Hills is Gold? And it's a different story about Chinese people, mostly two children, and their travels across America at the time of the gold rush. It also has a kind of aspect of magical realism. So join us for that one too. Thanks, as always, for joining us for this, and look forward to having you here next week on The Avid Reader.